to Opening Dharma Access, a podcast where we hear stories from BIPOC teachers about their Dharma experiences and practice and how these inform the ways they are sharing the Dharma today. I'm Reverend Leon, your host for this episode. Joining me today is Dalila Bothwell. She is a Dharma practitioner in the Insight Meditation Theravada Buddhist tradition and a graduate of Spirit Rock's Community Dharma Leader Program. She served as Deputy Director of New York Insight Meditation Center for nearly a decade, where she learned the priceless value of Sangha and the role relationships play in embodying the teachings and in creating kinder human beings. With a formal education in food and nutrition, her practice meets at the intersection of physical and emotional well-being while being Black and queer, and her love of recovery, nature, community, and justice. A native of the Southwest, Dalila currently lives in Papago, Tohono O'odham territory in Arizona with her handsome pup, Briscoe. Welcome, Dalila.
Thank you, Reverend Leanne.
Yeah, it's good to see you, and it's good to be co-creating with you again as we met each other, I think, initially in Buddhist Peace Fellowship for one of the gatherings. And then, of course, you're part of the Dharma Being Anti-Racist teaching team in 2020 and 2021 during the pandemic, both by Access to Zen and Spirit Rock. So I'm happy that we're working together again, as you will be one of the new co-hosts of Opening Dharma Access. So huge happiness, not just welcome, but happiness to be with you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Part of what we're doing is interviewing you to introduce you to the listeners. You'll offer a practice later in the month. So why don't you start out by telling us how you identify racially, ethnically, and any other categories of social location that are of importance to you right now, and anything else you want to say to let the listeners know more about you.
Yeah, I appreciate the important to me right now because, well, the basic ways I identify are as Black and queer. Also non-binary, and I identify as someone in recovery and in 12-step programs. And what's important to me now also is one of the intersections of my life is identifying as a widow or someone who's lost a partner. And so that's a big part of my life at this point. The presence is very big. I imagine it won't always be so. But yeah, that's definitely a social location that I'm working with or being with now.
Yeah. And feel free to not answer it as if you don't want to. How has practice or the Dharma supported this location you're in as widow?
My wife, Maria Cabrera, how's the Dharma helped me in grief and with this location, this current location of widow? Well, I say current, but it'll always be a location for me, right? Like no matter how much time has passed, I will have always experienced the before and after of my life with her. With her in person, because I'm very clear that she's still with me. So how has the Dharma helped with me in this? And that the practice of surrender and refuge and Sangha has been helpful. So in surrender, I'm really thinking about surrendering to what's here right now, like just the clear seeing of grief and all the constellations, sensations, colors, emotions, everything that happens, right? And the capacity to open to it as much as possible. And when sometimes that capacity is more limited or when it's wider, that that's okay too. So the ability to not have to question grief has been a big part of how the Dharma has helped me. It's like, oh, this is what's here right now. I don't have to change it. And really the thing with grief in my experience was I didn't even have the energy to try to change it. Right. Like it was like, I was so, spent after caregiving, and, that by the time that she died, I was just like, you know, let the earth hold me, let the couch hold me, let my dog hold me. So that's what I mean by surrender and the refuge of the Dharma of clear seeing, of like, as I was saying, so surrendering to that refuge and the refuge of Sangha, of community, of great support systems from recovery and from the Dharma that just, you know, held me, that just allowed me to be, didn't try to change me. I was spared from some of the horror stories I've heard other people who are grieving go through around how people will say things to them and about their, about death and grief. And I've had people who just allowed me to have my journey and didn't try to change it. And also a big part of that were my parents and my family, right? They just, simply let me be. And so, and I think as I reflect on it now, because I had this practice for 15 years before my partner passed, my family was, and they were already kind of like this anyways, but they were, I had set up, there had been like a setup of how to be with our emotions and ourselves and our family dynamics in a way that was supportive. Mm-hmm. So when her death came and when her illness came, it wasn't a big change for us. Right. Mm-hmm. So that I'm thinking of like just basically karmic momentum in that way of love and support and allowing, you know, my parents really allowed me to have my own journey before all this. So I think that, does that answer your question? Is that clear? Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Okay.
And I really appreciate hearing about making that connection that practice is so much about supporting us to, I like to say, identify and then build a capacity to be with difficulties. Mm-hmm. And so maybe kind of as a way into the next question, you know, in your experience as a BIPOC Dharma practitioner, how were you supported to identify and hold and be with your identity as a BIPOC in practice? Mm-hmm. And if you were or weren't, what would you want to share that you would hope that there would be more support for BIPOC practitioners and teachers now?
You know, I've been thinking about this question, and I have to say that my experience, so when I grew up in Arizona, so predominantly white state, right? Even though I grew up in a military town, my parents were military, so it was more ethnically and racially diverse than most places. But I grew up with a affirming sense of my Blackness, right? Mm-hmm. So regardless of what kind of spaces I was in. Mm-hmm. So with this question about how, what would have been helpful to me as a BIPOC practitioner, well, let me say what's been helpful. So when I started exploring really meditation, because I didn't know the Dharma, like I just was like, I need to have some suffering relieved. So mm-hmm. I ended up going to Buddhist places in New York City and, sat with a few different, with sanghas and different traditions. And you know, it's New York City. So these places were, you know, there were a couple of black or brown people in the room, so it wasn't completely white. And so I was like, okay, you know, this is par for the course of life in America as a Black person, right? Mm. And I didn't know really what I was missing until I went to New York Insight and sat at the, at that time we were calling it POC, the People of Color Sangha, at New York Insight, and the teacher was Gina Sharp. Mm. And, you know, entering that space and was a different level of comfort and ease that I hadn't had around anybody other than like my family and my BIPOC friends, right? Mm-hmm. So I really, and also, you know, the Black Christian church, which is how I grew up. So, so yeah, that level of ease I hadn't, yeah, I didn't know what I was missing. And so, what was helpful to me was having that space, was having that, that touch, that contact, that feeling of community in ways where our experiences were centered.
Right? Our experience what?
Our experiences were centered.
Oh, centered. It was,
they weren't centered around whiteness or making white people feel comfortable. It was centered around how we live, survive, and find joy as BIPOC folks in our lives. Mm-hmm. So, so having said that, I would think what would be helpful, because I had that experience, but what would be helpful, of course, is to have more spaces like that, right? And to encourage, of course, more teachers, more practitioners, and not even, you know, like formal teachers, but to have peer groups, more Kalyana Mitta, more spiritual friendships of folks, so that, you know, one thing I've learned about being in recovery is the value of folks speaking the same language. And there's that level of understanding. So around Dharma, speaking the same language around Dharma and the way that we can interpret it and translate it through our lived experiences as BIPOC folks. Yeah.
So now that you're, they call you teacher, I think, in that program that you're doing, the very big teacher training program, or not?
They call me a mentor.
Meditation.
Yeah. I'm considered a mentor.
A mentor. Okay. Yeah, mentor. And they're producing mindfulness leaders,
mindfulness
or
meditation,
what's a
mindfulness meditation teachers.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So say something about that and how, what is the edge then of your teaching as a BIPOC teacher generally, right? Mm. And are they predominantly, I have no idea. I know it's thousands of people, but and I know it's worldwide in some ways, right? So are they predominantly non-BIPOCs? And then, yeah, so maybe what's the edge then of your teaching?
Yes. Yeah, most of the students I've gotten have been white folks. Sometimes people choose me because of my bio in food and nutrition or recovery. And my bio does state explicitly that I identify as being Black and queer, right? And so my edge is, as a teacher, is to continue to stay Black and queer, right? Like, so what does that mean in predominantly white spaces? It means that I talk about my experiences as a BIPOC person, and I talk about how other people who have been marginalized, who may not have been so, when folks are, when we're teaching about, when folks are learning about mindfulness of the body, right? To talk explicitly about how folks who are marginalized don't feel safe in their bodies, or how I myself, when I walk out of the house and wear a hood, I don't feel safe and completely safe in my body, right? And so to make that very plain to people, I really think about, you know, I have my father's name is Frank, and when he met my mother, they met on a blind date. He said, "My name is Frank, and that's just what I am, is Frank." And he's a very frank person, right? And so I grew up with that, and it has value, right? Uh-huh. And so I want to be frank, and my practice is to just make it plain, right? Like, it doesn't have to be controversial. It doesn't have to be confrontational. It's just like, very plainly, this is how particular people experience life. And this is very plainly, this is how sometimes the Dharma and mindfulness is centered around whiteness. And very plainly, like, just, you know, put the cards out on the table, and then we can talk about it. Mm-hmm. So my edge is to not censor my Black and queer and recovery experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a dialogue in the mind that happens. It's like, well, do I really want to say this? Does this need to be said? And, you know, so I have about six groups. And so, you know, depending on, you know, whether you get me at the first of the month or at the end of the month, it depends on like how my bravado goes. But yeah, it's, you know, it's always a dance with being Black and queer, and especially with me as I present with a bald head and, mm-hmm. you know, like around how what I communicate is received. And I have to let that not be a hindrance, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm always going to be misinterpreted and misunderstood in this mm-hmm. life mm-hmm. by somebody, right? Like, so I'm not going to allow, once again, I keep leaning into, okay, what needs to be said here? Like, if this group were predominantly BIPOC, would I say this? Uh-huh. Right. And so that's what I lean into. It's like, you all got a Black and queer mentor. And so this is going to be the Black and queer interpretation I'm going to share with you the Black and queer, it's my Black and queer experience of mindfulness and Dharma here. Uh-huh. And it's still a practice, you know, it's a practice of, you know, like I said, explicitly saying what's often left unsaid.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's because I was curious when you said, an edge, and correct me if I misheard it, an edge is not to let it be a hindrance. And that you said, oh, if I was in a teaching predominantly BIPOCs, would I say this or not? So sounds like it's a pause to bring that query up for yourself. No mm-hmm. pun intended. And then is it just your energetic level at the beginning or the end of the month? What is it that then say, okay, I'm going to say it versus, okay, I'm going to hold back? You know, and I'm sure mm-hmm. there's not one cookie cutter for that. It just, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think about what always is present in my mind is what my ancestors weren't able to do that I am mm-hmm. able to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like a lot of the time when I say these things is because I feel like my ancestors brought me this far to be able to say these things. Mm, right. Mm, mm. And I also question, and I also just look, is what I'm saying untrue or inaccurate? Mm. Is what's the energy behind it? Mm. Right. And what I'm saying is very true. It's a truth that they haven't heard. Mm, right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I often think about these things when, and how it will be received. And like, if someone ever says anything, I'm like, well, was I untrue in what I said? No. Right. Like, mm-hmm. as, you know, and I have to think about like the, my livelihood, right? Like, you know, if I say this, is my livelihood at stake. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always very clear. So yeah. So what, I think about my ancestors. I think about, you know, they weren't able to live the life that I've lived. They've given me this gift of being able to hopefully affect change positively. And I want to lean into that gift and not let it go to waste. Mm-hmm. And so usually I say it. Now, does that mean I say it without hesitation? No, right? Like, I still say the things that need to be said. I don't always say them gracefully. And you know, sometimes there's some internal trembling that happens. Mm-hmm. And but I often think about that Audre Lorde quote about saying what needs to be said because it profits me beyond mm-hmm. any effect. And it profits me and it profits my people, right? Like mm-hmm. BIPOC people, it profits. And it'll profit them, right? Mm-hmm. Because most likely they don't have any BIPOC people in their life. Mm-hmm. And if they do, they may not be having these conversations with them. Mm-hmm. Right. And so if, yeah. So, you know, I feel like it's my opportunity to show them, at least open the door to an experience that's not completely centered around whiteness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so then, like for instance, in the Dharma being anti-racist, we had small groups that mm-hmm. were like, we as teachers of color had students of color in our group only, and that was part of the format. So then what is the edge then when you are in all BIPOC groups as a teacher? What's your edge there?
That's a good question. I think my edge is to point out our lived realities as BIPOC people and also point out how that's not the only reality that exists, mm. right? So like affirming, yes, this happens in this world as Black and Brown people or BIPOC folks. And that's very true and valid, and how to care for ourselves in that way and honor that. And we can, and this other truth, this absolute truth, right? So the relative and the absolute. And also, if we weren't in a world where our Blackness or our brownness or Asianness was kind of like a marker, if we were just human beings with these beating hearts and these feelings and emotions, how can we care? How can we lean into that as well? So my edge is like validating that and affirming that, and also saying we can have both, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't have to be, and it's hard because actually there's a friend / student now who's like that. And it's like, you know, doesn't want to, the projections of Blackness and maleness of masculinity are being projected onto them, and they're uncomfortable with it. Mm-hmm. And rightfully so, right? And so there's this thing of like wanting to reject that. But our Blackness and our gender or non-gender or whatever are to be tended for to and cared for. And like, how do we not let those projections of what others of our society and our culture have prevent us from living these like fuller lives, these freer lives, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my edge. And I think the edge is really not having enough time, right? Like we're only with people for a few weeks or, you know, 30 minutes at a time. It's a lifetime practice. And it's like, mm-hmm. constantly pointing to. So the both and I think is my edge when teaching BIPOC folks or guiding mm-hmm. BIPOC folks is mm-hmm. both of these realities can exist and both of them are valid. Mm-hmm.
So I'm formulating the question, and it really is like it's just coming to me given hearing what you're saying. At first, I was thinking, as BIPOC teachers, when we're in predominantly white settings, and it feels like we have to work against oppression, racism in this case, and racialization. We have to kind of forward ourselves and our identity. Mm. And however, when we're with students of color, then we actually try to blend into the background and mm-hmm. and bring forth their identity in affirming ways and remind them of that they're more than just said identities. Mm-hmm. So, and then there was some question I was trying to formulate from that, but I can't pull it up right now. So I don't know. And I saw you nodding and stuff. So I don't know what, any thoughts or.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking the part I'm thinking about is the first half of what you were offering about when we're predominantly white spaces, like our identities are very present. Right. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's interesting because,
Well, I think it's also very present from not only because we're one of the few, and even to this day and age, we're one of the few teachers of color, and it's because exactly that we less of us are seen from the teacher seat, mm-hmm. or you know, And again, it depends where and all that. And it's pretty obvious. And we're talking very much about convert Buddhism. So mm-hmm. let's be clear about that, right? Mm-hmm. So in a way, to be anti-racist is to forward ourselves more. Because as you were saying, like leaning into saying you are Black and you are queer, because our voices and our experiences hasn't been heard. Mm-hmm. as a way to formulate and a way to express the Dharma through mm-hmm. our experiences. So that's, I mean, for me, that's part of it, right? That's why we have to uplift it and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To make visible, right.
Mm, exactly.
To bring us, our presence from the margins into the center.
Mm, exactly.
Yeah. Because what's coming to mind are, you know, all the ways that I'm conditioned as a BIPOC person, as a Black person who still works predominantly in predominantly white spaces, even their virtual spaces from home, right? Like, mm-hmm. And yeah, there's always that tension of, like I said, how much of myself to bring forward and to make plain. And also, you know, sometimes I'm very clear that I'm there because I'm a Black person, right? Mm. And as someone who, yeah, and because I want to make a living, and because I love the Dharma, and because I feel that my life experiences have value, I'm happy to be in that space, right? Mm. Like, mm-hmm. if I remember. The first time I saw, I was on retreat. I don't remember if it was a BIPOC retreat. It was at IMS. But the first time I saw Venerable Panawati, and a woman my color, she also had moles on her face. I don't see a lot of women with moles on her face like me, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget that. I was like, oh my goodness, right? So the like scene and with her Southern drawl and
bald head,
still exactly who she is, right? The former, I think she was a former Christian pastor. I don't know if it was Baptist or not, mm-hmm. but still very much had that for me, kind of rhythm and cadence and how she spoke as a Christian pastor, that it was very familiar for me. And so it all felt like home. And so to see that, to see her in her fullness was such a gift, and it still is. And so, you know, and you know, my presence may be a gift to other BIPOC folks. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, and I'm, if for me, it's also a gift to white folks too, right? Who may not even know it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so, yeah. It's important for other voices and Dharma doors to be opened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And as you were saying, especially in convert Buddhism, mm-hmm. And that it can look so many different ways, mm-hmm. right? Like that's, and that the languaging can be different. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, I was thinking, when I was thinking about this interview, there's this, it's on Black Twitter, of course. And there was this thread around, what if the Bible, the Christian Bible, had been translated in AAVE, African American Vernacular English? So people were interpreting verses of the Bible from the King James Version to African American Vernacular English. And I said to some friends, like, can you imagine if the suttas were translated to AAVE, like the connection that would make with folks, right? Uh-huh, and like, And so the languaging of that and the cultural understanding and underpinnings of that, which is, it would blow my mind. Mm-hmm. And so those are the kinds of things that I think about and I wonder about, like, yeah.
It's interesting. As you were saying that, I was thinking, oh yeah. You know, we talk about, obviously you and I, maybe you can read Pali, but I can't read Pali.
No, I can't.
So, okay. So, you know, when we think, oh, when it's translated into English, but then there's just like, what kind of English are we talking about?
Right.
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 Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. I always call it the King James version of like, like the suttas were translated by these King, like, you know, I'm assuming white European men. Right. Mm-hmm. And what if someone like Venerable Panawati had translated them? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why it's so important. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they were actually Christian. I can't pull up the blah, 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 the Pali Society texts or something were the first set, and they're very Christian. In Sri Lanka, yeah. I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, yeah. So that's why, on a certain level, more Dharma books from BIPOCs is really important.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And then that the audience is not convert white audience.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love it. You know, sometimes me and some other Black teachers think about, like, what if we all learned Pali and translated the suttas? Mm. Right? Like, what would that sound like and feel like?
Mm. Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm.
Maybe we can get a grant for that.
Yeah, I bet you could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. As we wrap up, anything else you want to say? Let the listeners know about yourself or...
No, I don't think there's anything else. I don't feel very complex or complicated or, you know, just like, yeah, this is me.
I'm gonna remember that story about your dad and Frank.
Oh, he's still very Frank. He's very, and people, it's interesting because my cousins, I have a couple of cousins who call me Cousin Frank because I'm so much like my father.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yes. So it's been a journey to accept the fact that I'm my father's child. Yeah.
Maybe one other question, and feel free if you want to answer or not. Mm-hmm. What are you looking forward to in joining Opening Dharma Access?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing different perspectives and people's stories and connection. You know, the connection is very important to me. And Yeah, so I'm looking forward to see how other people came across the Dharma and what it means for them, and finding similarities and finding. I've been thinking about the phrase lately from the Arsenio Hall show. This is, I don't know if you remember that show, but when Arsenio Hall used to have this segment called "Things That Make You Go Hmm," and like so. I am looking forward to those kinds of things, hearing from people like, oh, that's interesting. I have to marinate on that, meditate on that, right? So that's what I'm looking forward to. And I'm looking forward to having more BIPOC voices of the Dharma out there in the world, right? Yeah.
All right. And I said that was the last question, but I have one more because okay. I know you. I know you.
Okay.
I think, you know. Okay. If... And it just not doesn't have to be the be all and end all. And if your life or your teaching or your whatever now, what is your song now? Because I know you love your songs, and your music. Song or music right now is like really exciting to you, enlivening?
Oh, you know what? That's so funny. I know you because also when I came on, I had music playing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So the last couple of days I've been listening to this Ricky Martin CD from 19, I think it's called Vuelve. And I just love the ballads in it and the songs. And also he has this unplugged album that he did. There's a couple songs, Con Tu Nombre, that I love. And I've also been listening to Whitney Houston and her later albums, like from the 90s and 2000s.
Wow.
I love danceable music, right? So just like music that I can dance to. Yeah, not a lot of interpretation or like just good stuff. So that's what I've been listening to lately. And also some Celia Cruz. I have Celia Cruz's Best of Hits on CD in the car. So,
oh, goodness.
Yeah, it's old.
Yeah.
So lots of Bembe Cora. Yeah. So that's what I've been listening to lately. It's my soundtrack. Yeah.
All right. Things kind of lift your energy and get you moving.
Yes, exactly. I need energetic music in my life, for sure.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing yourself and introducing yourself to our listeners.
Thanks for having me, Reverend Leanne. I appreciate the question around music too, because you know, as you said, you know, I love music. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. This has been Reverend Leanne, your host for this episode for Opening Dharma Access with incoming new host, Dalila Bothwell, sharing that Dharma experience as a BIPOC teacher. We're so happy to have her join us for season 2 of ODA. Look for hers, Lama Karma Yeshe Chodron, and also incoming new host, Sister Peace, as they will be sharing their discussions with more teachers in the coming months. Look for our new episodes on the first Tuesday of every month. In between episodes, we'll also share a meditation, mindfulness practice, chant, or another form of practice from our guests with you. Come back to check that out to keep on listening to our BIPOC teachers. Be sure to subscribe for notifications and rate and review the podcast to help us spread the word. Check the episode notes for resources and email us at suddenleap.2z@gmail.com with any questions. Let's open Dharma access to all beings.